Okay, so some Rashi's for Parshas Shoftim. As you may hear, it's still quiet in the background. It's the first day of Chodesh Elul, but the boys are still coming, arriving, getting adjusted, so this year is not taking place in the loud, raucous Beis Medrash, but in a quiet room. Hopefully by next year there'll be a loud Beis Medrash in the Kol Torah, which especially for so many people is so deeply yearned for during Elul, so at least to hear the Kol Torah and to feel that you're back in the Beis Medrash. But this is still a quiet, as I call it, library shiur, library lecture. So let's start with an interesting pasuk in the beginning of Parsha Shoftim. This is pasuk Chaf Beis, the last pasuk of Perek Tezayin. So the Torah, after prohibiting an Asherah tree is obviously a tree that was worshipped as a Avodah Zarah, that was idolized, that was converted into a pagan shrine, into a pagan object of ritual, of worship, obviously, can't be planted near the Mizbeach. Not only that, but in general, lo takim locha matzeva. Don't use a matzeva, not near the Beis HaMikdash, but any matzeva. Asher senei Hashem elokecha. Okay, so those are very, very harsh words. Hashem hates. Doesn't really speak about Hashem hating much in the Torah, except for, of course, aberrant behavior, criminal behavior, moral behavior, disobedient behavior. Hashem doesn't hate chazir. Hashem doesn't hate basar b'chalav. If anything, there are certain objects which are to'eva. And to'evas hagoyim, most of the time, these are the abominations when human beings act in ways that are abominable through their, the way the Torah describes it, sexual behavior, food that they eat. It doesn't say Hashem hates. Hashem hates enemies of the Jewish people. Hashem hates murderers. Hashem hates murder. I remember Rav Lichtenstein was such a soft-spoken and kind-hearted person, which a lot of people don't know. A lot of people think of him through his lectures and his shiurim as this scintillating intellect, as this Talmud Chacham towering. But his midos and his kindness doesn't come through unless you knew him. And those who knew him can't help but remember the midos. And I never heard him say the U word, I hate. I would never use that word. When people use that word, I feel many ways frightened by it, intimidated by it. I feel offended by it. It's an alien word to me. The only time I heard Rav Lichtenstein use the word hate is he said, I hate laziness. He never used the word about people. I hate laziness. So you read this pasuk, Asher Sonei Hashem. What's wrong with a stone? It's just one large stone that was raised as a matzeva. So of course Rashi fills in the blanks. Matzeva is one stone as opposed to a mizbeach, which is multiple stones or made out of earth. Mizbeach avanim, mizbeach adama. Ve'azu Sonei, what does Hashem hate or detest? This type of matzeva. Ki chol kaisa leknanim. Because it was affiliated with Avodah Zarah, because the idol worshippers, the paganists, would also create these one stone, presumably vertical stones, tall stone monuments, and they were sites of worship. Okay, so that explains it. That explains the word Asher Sonei. Why does Hashem hate it? Nothing wrong with the stone. Nothing has animate life to it or spirit to it. It's just a stone. Nothing Hashem hates. A chazir isn't inherently hated by Hashem as opposed to a cow. Hashem ostered one and permitted another. And the behavior is criminal. Eating chazir is criminal. A chazir itself isn't criminal. Basar b'chalav itself isn't dastardly. There's nothing inherently animate about stones or animals or trees. But culturally, they're associated with a religion and a theology and a movement and a period of idolatry, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu detested because people erred and were theologically confused. And part of our mission was to bring humanity out of that period. And Baruch Hashem, we have brought humanity out of the heavy period of paganism. So that explains the Asher Sonei. Then Rashi says something fascinating. Wait a second. Look back and say for Bereishis. There are matzevos all over the place. Probably the most famous religious, ritualistic matzeva is matzeva of Yaakov. For even azos asher samti matzeva yibes elokim. Of course, there are matzevas between Yaakov and Lavan, but those don't seem to be ritualistic or religious. They seem to be more diplomatic and political. But there are matzevas in Sefer Bereishis. So Rashi says, well, it was once something which was certainly not hated or detested, and in many ways even coveted by Hashem. But sana, achshav sana, now Hashem hates them. Me'achar she'asu elu chok l'avodah zar. Now, I see two very interesting conversations bubbling beneath this Rashi. Number one, that there really is an impact of erroneous religious theology. It does impact the world. You and I would think, of course, it's all silly, as it is. Masi de Adam, we just said today in Hallel, it was a Chodesh Elul, Einayim lehem v'lo yiron, Einayim lehem v'lo yishmo, Aflim v'lo yirichon. They have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, and they don't hear. It's all just a figment of people's imagination. It's all just some crazed error of moral and theological confusion. There's no validity to it. We just ignore it. It's like a dog barking in the night. Who cares? Just ignore it. Move on here. What ability could Avodah Zarah and that culture possibly have to affect aspects of Hashem's natural world? They are so much more transcendent. Not that the aspects of the world are transcendent. That's an oxymoron. If they're in this world, they're not transcendent, but they were created by Hashem. How could a system that we don't take seriously, that we laugh at, that we scoff at, that's empty, that's meaningless, yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants His presence to be recognized in this world? That's the source of life. And when that presence is contested or denied, the objects that are used for that denial of Hashem's presence become counterforces. They themselves don't inherently possess, but Hashem dislikes them, and we're meant to dislike the Muslims. Hashem is trying to project His dislike to us because we're meant. So first of all, it speaks about that Avodah Zarah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, gave Avodah Zarah the capacity to change human minds and the capacity to affect, as it were, His presence in this world. And the more mistakes that human beings make, the greater the error, the less HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is felt in this world. And this is an interesting metaphoric statement about a phrase that appears two or three times, Asher Chalak Lahem, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Torah describes primarily, say, for Devarim. Take, for example, the Pasuk in Veschana in Perek Dalet. This is Pasuk Yutes. Moshe Rabbeinu is warning us against Avodah Zarah. Don't look to the heavens, and you'll see the sun, you'll see the moon, and you'll see the stars. V'nidachta, you'll be dislodged from authentic, accurate theological thought, vishtachavisa lahem, and you will bow to them, bavaritam, asher chalak Hashem elokecha osam l'chol amim tachas hashamayim. And one of Rashi's interpretations for asher chalak, Hashem distributed them, Hashem allocated them, why is Hashem allocating Avodah Zarah? So Rashi more or less interprets Hashem enabled that thought to take root in the human mind, part of freedom of choice, that human beings can choose freely the way they view God, the way they view HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in this case, erroneous views of God. So Hashem creates theological opportunity for error, and that error impacts the world. It impacts the presence of Hashem, and this is a very literally concrete impact. Well, it's a mixed metaphor because the stone isn't concrete, but it's a solid concrete impact that something which was so beloved to the Avos is now forbidden. Okay. The second, actually, there are three conversations bubbling beneath this. The second one, the No Talmidim, I feel greater license to be more elaborate. When the Talmidim are sitting there waiting to get the breakfast, I feel like I've got to end in 10, 12 minutes because the breakfast is waiting and the shiur is beginning. A second issue bubbling beneath the surface is that if Hashem detests objects that are associated with Avodah Zarah, then we are also meant to detest them. And that's fallen sometimes, I feel, in the modern world a little bit into, I would say, neglect, unfortunately. Don't get me wrong, okay? I understand and am fully appreciative that Christianity is a move, is a veer towards monotheism, is a movement. I just had a conversation with an incoming Talmud who listened to one, a boy just arrived today, who asked me about this. He heard a shir, I spoke about Christianity, its moral spirit, and yet the moral spirit seems so different from Jewish morality. And I said, correct, but before Christianity, moral spirit more or less didn't exist within religious thought, within political thought, and Judaism always stood for, asserted moral responsibility, compassion, care for the weak, care for the vulnerable, and Christianity adopted that, and of course, corrupted it, rerouted it, re-engineered it, but I certainly see the advent of Christianity as part of the what I call the movement towards monotheism, the march towards monotheism. But forgetting the historical implications of Christianity and its persecution of the Jews, of our people, but it's still
it's still laden with vestigial paganism. It's still paganistic. Any attempt to create any physical element of God is completely, completely unacceptable, is completely idolatrous. And sometimes when people pass churches, especially when they travel and they're in foreign lands, and especially in Europe where the churches have works of art or are themselves structures of art. So first of all, you have to be extremely cautious about not entering any church which is still operating. That is probably an isser. And when I say any church that's still in operation, even if it has ceremonies and rituals infrequently, that is still considered a church in operation. So I'm referring to in particular to the Sistine Chapel in Rome, which a lot of tourists unwittingly enter because it's part of the Vatican tour, which is a highly recommended tour because you see a lot of interesting historical facts about the Jewish people, but or about their interaction with Rome. But you have to be careful not to enter the Sistine Chapel towards the conclusion of the tour, because at least the way it was presented to me by the tour guides and the people who delivered the information, the local authorities, there are still sacramental rituals once a year. And you should be very careful. It's almost impossible not to walk through the Sistine Chapel, not to walk through that final part of the tour. There's a side door. Okay, that's just one example. But a lot of people, I think, are very callous in entering churches for concerts and entering churches because of art, entering churches because of cultural events. And it's something which is probably bordering on an isser, if not usser itself. I don't want to posit because I know people have certainly not operating churches usser. A church that meets every week or every day for prayers or weekly prayers. But the second issue is not just entering churches, but even like I remember, where were we? My wife and I were in Barcelona, and one of the main attractions was the Gaudí Church or the Gaudí Cathedral, and I felt like it's not a place we should be. It's not a place we should be walking and taking pictures and snapping pictures. And I thought of this pasuk, Asher Sanei Hashem Elokecha, and if Hashem detests the items, in this case, the locations associated with paganism. So to walk by and say, oh, that's a beautiful church, it's a beautiful building, I didn't feel it's in concert with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's desire that we should continue the process of eliminating any trace of idolatry, any trace of Avodah Zarah, any trace of those erroneous theological ideas that distance him from our world. That should be our attitude. Excuse me if I'm a little bit disjointed, but it's been a long day. It's been a very hot day in Eretz Yisrael. The third discussion bubbling beneath this Rashi, which is also fascinating, is that there could be different rules and different realities and different conditions from the period of the Avos to our period. And just because something was true in the days of the Avos doesn't mean that it's true in our day, because history has changed in this case. I would say the halachic map, because the Avos weren't operating in the classic revealed system of halacha, but changed what we would call religious guidelines, religious behavior. So you're right, if you backtrack, if you rewind 4,000 years, a matzeva, 3,000 years, a matzeva was the legitimate form of worshiping Hashem. Yaakov worshipped Hashem at a matzeva. But now it's 2023. Doesn't mean we're better than the Avos, God forbid. But it also means that there are changes. I remember a long, long time ago, Parshas Vayetze, I was hosted in a community, I won't disclose which, but it was open mic part of Shabbos where anyone from the community could ask the visiting speaker, in this case, yours truly, whatever question was on their mind. Someone asked me the question of Parshas Vayetze for wise guys. What's the question for wise guys? Did Yaakov kiss Rachel? If you say no, you're being historically and textually inaccurate. If you say yes, well, if Yaakov could kiss a single woman named Rachel, why are we so careful about Negia? Why are we so careful about Yichud? Why are we so careful about Dvarim Shel Chiba? So I tried to answer his question in a broader sense. And he said there are four periods to Jewish history. There's pre-Sinai, from Har Sinai till the Churban, from the Churban till our return to Eretz Israel, and now I believe we're entering the fourth stage of history, and I've talked about this in other contexts, I won't elaborate, but let's focus on the first three. And halachic practice is an amalgam, is an aggregate. And as history unfolds, new halachos are incorporated, new elements are added, new minhagim, new traditions, new masaras. So just because a particular event was appropriate in the old shepherd days of Yaakov, and it was totally appropriate for him to kiss Rachel in that context, given ours, and I don't just mean ours, 2023, but the last 2,000 years of rabbinic tradition, and in particular our world, which is certainly over-sexualized, but even without the over-sexualization of our world, it would be inappropriate for a young man to kiss, certainly, a young woman to whom he's not married in that public or any context whatsoever. So the same thing here. It's amazing to imagine that a action or a ceremony, which was a ritual ceremony, which Yaakov probably saw in the same way we see our davening or we see our korbanos, certainly, and there was an entire mesechta of korbanos called Meseches Matzeva. For us, this is associated with Avodah Zarah. History has altered the equation. And at this stage in history, Asher Sanei Hashem Elokecha. So this one Rashi produces three very different conversations. Conversation number one, that Avodah Zarah does impact the world, is not something we just take lightly, tisk tisk, and brush aside, but it is a real battle over the presence of Hashem. And a stone could be forbidden even though it was once coveted. Number two, if Hashem hates it, we should hate it also. Number three, just because a particular norm or behavior was appropriate in the days of the Avos doesn't mean that it still is. Okay. Next Rashi. These are Rashis that are very close to my heart. I've thought about this next Rashi for many, many, many years. It's one of the psukim, one of the Rashis I constantly think about. It's a very, very famous, famous Rashi. It's in Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Yud Aleph, in which the Torah demands that we listen to the Beis Din in this case, but it's a broader instruction about what we would call Samchus Chachamim, Samchus Chazal, Torah Shebal Peh, listen to their instructions. Very famous pasuk. Don't veer. Don't deviate. Don't disagree. Right or left. It's a very famous Gemara in Sanhedrin. Rashi quotes the Gemara. Afilu omri lecha al yamin shehu smol, v'al smol shehu yamin. So extreme should our obedience and submission to Chazal be that even if they tell you your right hand is your left hand and your left hand is your right hand, things which are obvious to us, things which are intuitive to us, things which are instinctive to us, even in that instance, we should defer to their judgment. So first, a few comments upon the terminology of left and right, and then I'll relate to Rashi's. I can't miss this opportunity. These are words which people just throw around. I think more in Israel than in America, believe it or not. I know a lot of people listening to this in America and in other polarized Anglo communities across the world, not only Jewish polarization, but polarized democracies. You can't imagine how often I hear those terms, the left and the right and the left. And I refuse. I refuse to be trapped by those terms. I refuse to use those terms. I may use terms such as conservative thinking people, liberal thinking people, because conservatism represents a particular approach to life, to traditions, to the old way, to old values, with its benefits and disadvantages. Liberalism represents a different approach to life. Progressivism, new ideas, changing to adapt to newfound values, a care perhaps for those who don't agree or accord with your background, race, religion, sexual orientation. It has its strengths. It has its weaknesses and disadvantages. But I don't know why and we are the concepts of left and right entered. Why should liberalism be left? Because it begins with the letter L. That can't be true because there are other religions and other languages in which liberalism is not L. And certainly conservatism doesn't begin with R. So I don't know why these were assigned as codes. And I'm opposed to them for two reasons. Number one, because by describing those as codes, you lead to what I call groupthink or clustered thinking, where, well, if I'm left, then these are the bylines and the guidelines and the ideas that left-wing people believe in and are meant to believe in. So, and if I'm right, because they create these larger labels that I submit my thinking to, and here's what a left-leaning person, rather than thinking about issues individually, do you support them? Do you not support them? Allowing yourself to cross these terrible aisles, as they say in the Congress of the United States, and to say, well, in this respect, I agree with the Democrats, to actually show subtlety, authentic thought, nuanced thinking, complex processing. And the second you create left and right, you almost divide yourself into different zones. Second of all, even if I were to choose terminology, why would I use left and right? Because then someone who, let's say, sees themselves as left, there's something about right that's very criminal and ornery and dangerous, and left and right are just different vectors in our life. And believe me, it could change your behavior. If you see right in a certain way, making a right turn to a progressive, that could seem like a racist crime, and making a right turn, that can see, or a left turn for a conservative can see. So I hate, I shouldn't use the word I hate, but I strongly, strongly fear the impact of simplistic sloganeering and simplistic labeling, and certainly when it's expressed as left and right. And certainly, Kal Vachomer, when people use that about religion, he's more left and less firm. First of all, what does that even mean? Even if you issue the comment, they're more liberal and less firm, that itself is a very troubling comment, because liberalism just means you think about certain changes in ways that may be very important religiously. Religion wants us to change our world, to advance our world in ways that are driven to greater moral sensitivity, greater civic responsibility, greater... Now, it happens to be, I would imagine, that many liberal, progressive people in our world also happen to be less religious, because it's harder to blend liberalism and religion, because religion is preserving the past and preserving traditions. But we don't take our cues from what's happening in foreign religions or other countries. We take our cues from trying to be the best Oved Hashem we can be. So my hair stands on end when I read this pasuk and I think about how our world has become polarized in general by slogans, and in particular by left and right. Okay, so that's just my rant for the day. But what about Rashi? Now, it can't mean, I'll tell you what this Rashi does mean. It does mean that our respect for Chazal should be so powerful, should be so compelling, that even if we think differently, we should submit to their wisdom, to their judgment. And of course, this to me is one of the most important, we call it fault lines, maybe I would, of our world, of our Jewish world today, the ability to accept the authority of Chazal. That was a major break of Reform the Conservative. They were unwilling to accept. That's the or at least to completely accept it. That's the major, major, I think, an existential fissure, to be able to look back to this group of people that were so close to Har Sinai and were so mega immersed in Torah, and so massively engaged, they achieved what I would call para-prophetic knowledge of Torah. And they set in place a system. They set it in place, but they codified it and articulated it. And that's really the challenge that I see in my life. I'm starting it each year again, is to bring a new generation of young men and young women into that orbit, to teach them the beauty of Torah Sheba'al Peh, and to allow that instruction to trickle down into an appreciation of their world of Chazal and of the rabbinic tradition in general. That's why it kills me when rabbis act inappropriately and they alienate people from local and contemporary rabbinic experience, and that starts to bleed backwards into rejection of Chazal. So I think that to me is one of the, as you can probably hear in my voice, one of the issues that I've dedicated my educational life to. And obviously, we have to defer to their judgment. But when it's so, so obvious, let's say, for example, Chazal were to tell us that it's day and not night, and we didn't live in Alaska or Greenland. We're living in New York or in Alonshvot, and it's clearly day. It would be us to listen to them and to feel that it's night. Again, it could be a cloudy day, but if, let's say, they completely altered every single day from when the sun sets, that's called day, and when the sun rises, that's called night. Daven Maariv, when the sun rises, and Daven Shachris, that would be completely contravening our reality. And that's not what the Drasha says. So why did Chazal use this metaphor? Obviously, they use the metaphor because of the pasuk and Shoftim. What does it mean when Chazal tell you your left is your right and your right is your left and defer to Chazal? To me, what I think it means, without in any way diminishing our respect for, our reverence for, and our submission to Chazal, but it can't be that Hashem is asking us to submit to Chazal when it's complete. For me personally, I may make a mistake, so I have to submit. But let's say the entire community knows that it's day. It's not my hallucination. It's like I'm jet lagged. So no, HaKadosh Baruch Hu couldn't tell us it's day, but behave as if it's night. Just look at the reality. It's not even how Chazal speaks. How could Chazal interpret a pasuk in the Torah in a way that they themselves wouldn't condone? I think what it means is as follows. If I'm facing you, and I'm talking to you, rather than turning my back on you, essentially, my right is your left. And when I say the word right, I'm referring to your left because I'm looking at your left hand and vice versa. So our relationship with Chazal should be one of facing them, listening, the way we listen when people communicate to us whom we respect, we face them, rather than the inverse or the opposite condition where you'd be turning your back towards Chazal, in which case you're not paying attention or reverence to them metaphorically, in which case your left is still their left and your right is still their right. So this metaphor is how we should view Chazal. We should embrace, imagine a person called Chazal, and you walk towards that person and face that person and listen to that person. And that person would say, this is what you should do with your right hand, or with the right hand, he'd be referring to your left hand. This is what you should do with the left hand, he'd be referring to your right hand. So it's the respect we should have, the relationship. That's why the metaphor is not, even if they tell you day is night or night is day, zero is one, one is zero. A man is a woman is a man. These obvious situations, Chazal would never contravene reality. We'd never be placed into that situation. You see, it's just hyperbole, even. I don't think the Torah would speak in hyperbole that's empty. I think there's a meaning and a message behind this hyperbole. Stand in front of Chazal. Face them. Awe them and their tradition. Have awe for their tradition. As if you'd be standing in front submitting to them. And the way the Torah describes that posture, that moment, that encounter is, well, if you're facing them, then their right is your left and their left is your right. And they'd be speaking in a way that you may not, and here's the punchline, you may not be able to articulate within your own world, because for you, the right is what's on, you'd call it the right hand and you'd call it the left hand. But if you put yourself into their voice, their wisdom, their traditions, listen, look at yourself through them. And when you're looking at yourself through them, your right for them is the left, your left for them is the right. So I didn't make it through the five Rashis I had planned, but Mirza Shem, soon we'll have a loud base madrash. Shabbat Shalom.